Okay.
Coming back, I'd start just with two written questions and open it up for everyone. One of them, I'll take this one first. Do you consider yourself a Catholic Christian? I love the word Catholic. The idea is universal. And I tried in my education to be as universal as I could. Jesus said, I have sheep in other folds. Ideas of there are many mansions in my father's house, this sort of thing. Because if Thomas took the gospel, the good news, to India, I made a number of trips to India, and I met not just Christians, but Buddhists and Hindus and Jainists and Parsis and others. What is a Christian? I mean, Jesus himself was a Jew. The first two generations were Jesus-loving Jews. Then after the destruction of the second Jewish temple by the Romans in the year 70 AD, it was no longer favorable or advantageous to be identified with Jewishness. Because, and we see this in the development of the Q text, as scholars like Burton Mack and others have sleuthed out, there's a second layer of teachings being now put into Jesus' mouth. There's an original Q1 layer, which seems to be authentic statements by Jesus, and then there's a Q2 layer, which seems to be this community of people who are inspired by Jesus. They're in their old age, or their children or grandchildren, they began to feel rejected by the greater Jewish world. There was tension, in other words. It's like a new religious movement. And they began to kind of start sniping, feeling resentful, and a bit petty. And their Jesus, they now want to start putting words into his mouth that express some of that resentment, that sense of competition with the outer society. So we see that, here's the rub. The spirituality of Jesus, that Albert Nolan is doing such a lovely job and in a lovely multifaceted way trying to bring out all the different facets of this diamond of Jesus. Although I would add that there's many more facets he could have brought out. And that's why you might want to read Stephen Davies' Jesus the Healer. It will bring out those other facets. But when you look at Jesus, in the early community, you see that the spirituality Jesus lived within a few generations got turned into a religion about Jesus, a myth-making enterprise about Jesus, being the second person of the Trinity, the only Son of God. This is a completely non-Jewish notion. It's a Roman notion. Every emperor worth their salt had some plaques and shields saying, he is the Son of God, and they would wear it as a title. The Christians put that tag on Jesus, the Son of God. The Q2 layer introduces this idea of Jesus as the Son of Man. And it's a mysterious phrase. The Academy of New Testament scholars have gone back and forth a lot on this one as to whether it just means like every man, the way of saying oneself, or does it have some apocalyptic, like Book of Daniel kind of association with some kind of end times eschatological prophet or something. I'm of the mind, I'm persuaded by those scholars to say it has a kind of oneself, every man kind of connotation to it when Jesus called himself Son of Man. But we're not sure that Jesus himself actually used that, because it mainly gets introduced in that Q2 layer. Oh, there's so many things. We need to do a 20 or 40 hour course on that. Jesus' own spirituality that he was sharing, transmitting, modeling in an exemplary way for these Jesus lovers, the people of the way, as they were known among themselves. And they were wayfarers. They were itinerants. The big question is if Jesus, and I believe he was, really open psychically, if he had this virtual omniscience, like we see with Ramana Maharshi, Amma, the Buddha, Padre Pio, and others, he could very easily know what was going on in India without having to make the trip there as a youth, or if he survived the crucifixion, which is a big controversy. The John Gospel makes it clear that they're preparing a crypt and bringing in the scenes with huge vats of aloe vera and other healing balm and materials to maybe rehabilitate Jesus. And then did it, Paul actually met Jesus up in Damascus, where Jesus had been kind of taken off and under the seclusion of darkness or something, the cover of darkness, so he can continue his ministry. And then they think he went off to India. Well, he doesn't need to have gone to India to know what was going on. You had Buddhists and Jain monks, and maybe Hindu sannyasins coming on the boats or the overland route. There was a naked Jain from India living in Rome, a huge sensational figure. I mean, it was a cause celebre in Rome, like second or third century before Christ. The maritime routes were busily trafficked by boats coming from India to the Middle East and Southern Europe all the time. That had been going on for 2,000 years before Jesus, and certainly in a few hundred years before Jesus, the trade had intensified with the Roman Empire. So it's very easy for Jesus to meet itinerant Buddhists or Hindu or Jaina monks. And I don't know if any women made that trip. They would have easily been raped or something. That was a problem for itinerant homes, women, east and west. That is from Asia to the west into the Middle East. So Jesus very easily could have picked up the idea of the lifestyle for his early Christians, the people of the way, by meeting or clairvoyantly just seeing all of these wanderers who live on bhiksha, on alms, in South Asia, in the subcontinent, India. So his people of the way, these Jesus lovers, they were not Christians, they were Jews. A whole camp of these Jewish Christians, the Nazorians, I forget the other name for them, the Nazarites, yet another name, Edomites, flourished up into the 4th and 5th century in the Palestine area. They somehow survived all that Roman persecution when the Romans in 70 AD said enough of these zealots and these troublemaking Jews who were trying to overturn our Pax Romana, off with their heads, and they just mass slaughter. They destroyed the second Jewish temple. The Mark Gospel apparently gets put together right after that. And that's where Christianity begins. It's these Jewish, Jesus-loving people, these people of the way, who suddenly realize, oh my God, it makes much more sense to be part of the Roman, Greco-Roman, Hellenistic, Mediterranean mystery school tradition of religions, like the cult of Osiris and Demeter and Persephone, and the cult of Mithras, which is huge. That had a big influence on the development of Christianity as a paganized Hellenistic mystery school religion. You have early church fathers, I think like Tertullian and others, openly boasting to his Roman friends, our Christianity, it's not like that Jewish thing you guys despise. It's like your own Mediterranean mystery school. See, we have a slain and resurrected Messiah like Osiris. We have a God who comes from beyond the world like Mithras. Almost every Roman centurion was belonged to the cult of Mithras. There's some really fine stuff on the internet about that. I'm forgetting the scholar's name. I had some dialogue with him back when I was dialoguing with all these guys and gals in 1995-96 and giving myself a New Testament crash course study. Every day I was spending hours emailing these guys, reading their books and articles, reading their posts. It came out of a crosstalk forum. But when you read all that, you wonder, what is a Christian? There was a big controversy for several centuries before the Nicene Creed got worked out as to what is a Christian. For instance, Arius and Athanasius, do you believe Jesus was a human being? He might have been a divine incarnation, coming in with no karma, so to say, no personal issues to work out, who from the get-go just available as a servant of humanity. He might have clearly been a spiritual prodigy. So many of the Catholic saints we read about, certain Protestant saints, some of these saints we find in other religious traditions. So Jesus himself was not a Christian. To be a Christian in the second century was different than being a Christian in the fourth century. Were you a Christian who practiced open table fellowship, or were you part of that emerging institutional control structure that wanted you to only come to God through the sacraments? And for that, you needed priests who had been ordained by bishops. It was a control mechanism to make sure women couldn't have power and people were too mystical, couldn't have power. There was a big rivalry going on. People who had been martyred were considered the real saints. They had laid their lives on the line for this way of that Jesus had lived and enjoined on others. And there were a number of these people who were considered martyrs, but they survived. The Roman emperor who gave the edict for their death died. But they were just about to be martyred. They were heroes in early Christianity, and people flocked to them. There was a cult, in the sense of a gathering of people around a charismatic type figure. Whether they had healing powers or not, frankly, I'm not real impressed when I read about the martyrs in terms of their real degree of spirituality, mystical spirituality. Most of them, it's kind of like, I'm a Christian, screw you Romans, you can put me to death. But some of them seem like little authoritarians. It's very insider, outsider, exclusivist, black and white thinking. But I will say, you know, how many of us are willing to die for our faith? And that they had tremendous courage. So they have cults around them. And those up in Rome and elsewhere who were overseeing this emerging institutional version of Christianity, they didn't like this one bit, that the people were fleeing their churches to go hang out around those who had nearly been martyred, or people who had certain healing gifts, or other gifts of the Spirit, the charismata, as Paul identifies them. So what kind of a Christian are you? Are you part of the Thomas community kind of Christianity? Very mystical, and, you know, who am I? People are obsessed about the last days, eschatology, the apocalypse, the final judgment, and, you know, last times. In the Gospel of Thomas, we read that the disciples came to Jesus and said, can you tell us about when the last days will be? What will it be like? What are the signs and omens for that? And Jesus says, in a classic kind of intuitive mystical stage kind of statement, the same you kind of get from a Ramana Maharshi in India or the Zen Buddhist tradition, the ancient Upanishads of India. Jesus says, have you discovered the beginning that you can now ask about the end? There where the beginning is, there the end is. Blessed is he who takes himself at the beginning before he came into being. That's like a Zen koan, like where were you a zillion years ago? What were you before your parents' birth? What are you as a spirit? Gospel of Thomas is all about going beyond conventional identification with being a body and a mind. The religious convention is that beyond being just a body and a mind, protoplasm with a voiceover, you are a soul. You are a soul. A unique, distinct, lovable, and hopefully loving person, that if you are truly loving, you will one day go to heaven. And you will see God, who is some kind of super soul, the supreme being above all its other beings, in some kind of a heaven. And the big riddle you have to grapple with here, get straight now, says Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas. Don't wait until the fire comes. That is maybe your own karma, your own life history hitting you in the face with your own lack of virtue or love or clarity. Let me go to the heaven to see the super being God. How far away is he going to be sitting on that throne? 2 feet away? 8 feet away? 40 feet away? Well, you don't want it 1,000 feet away. You want some intimacy. There's a whole model that you are an embodied type of soul, and God is some kind of embodied super soul, the twinkly, beautiful eyes. No matter how beautiful his grin and eyes and money, woolly beard or whatever, or like, you will get jaded with that. It's simply an object, an image, a form, and God is without image or likeness. And in Genesis, when it says, I was telling a class the other day, when Genesis says, we are created in the image and likeness of God, well, all the mystics and the better theologians, St. Thomas Aquinas, Meister Eckhart, Maimonides in the Jewish world, they're all saying God has no image. So it's a koan for you. That's the Zen word for the Chinese gonan in the Chinese Zen tradition, meaning a mind-breaking riddle or enigma, a question that explodes your normal, rational, conditioned mind and opens you up to the reality of spirit. The Buddha, the ancient Upanishads say we must go beyond the heavens. God is not an anthropomorphized man-like figure. Jesus is saying the same thing in the Gospel of Thomas and in the other Gospels. even our Orthodox canonical biblical tradition gives very transpersonal or superpersonal definitions for God. God is love, God is light, God is truth, God is, you know, some of the metaphors like this amazing bubbling spring from which you drink and get God intoxicated. That's one of the prime themes of the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of John. And Jesus asks, can you drink of me, basically? He's not talking about bisexual oral copulation. He's talking about, which is again what people like, you know, G.A. Wells or Kurtz rather than some kind of freak. No, he's talking about a deep mystical inebriation. Yes, Anna?
What would you say if Jesus is just, you know, is one of many incarnations? What would you say, or what do you think it makes Jesus so unique, or would be the unique contribution, or why?
Because he's alive right now. If you really get what he is as undying, spiritless, deathless spirit, the uncreated aspect of the soul, you see, we're not just body, mind, and soul. We are spirit with a capital S. What in India, ancient India, our most ancient wisdom text, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, closely followed by the Chandogya Upanishad, are the biggest and the oldest of the Upanishads, and make it quite clear our real nature is this capital S spirit, what they call the Atman. You can think of itself with a capital S. Prior to and far beyond, including but completely transcending the ego self sense, the me, myself, and my. Jesus, quite clearly to me, from the time I was reading those Gospels at age 16, and what I was satisfactorily able to deduce, dialoguing with all the New Testament scholars and then looking at all this cross-cultural, interreligious literature about all the great holy men and women, the real apparent divine avatars that come into us. And Christianity, I think, has had them. St. Francis and some of these child prodigy people, they're amazing figures in Christendom. If you just go get Alvin Butler's Lives of the Saint and Donald Atwater's updating of it. And Joan Carol Cruz's books on modern saints. She has two volumes of saints who led very saintly lives for the last 150 years, but lived too recently to be in the classic four volumes. Big volumes of Alvin Butler's encyclopedic Lives of the Catholic Saints. When you read about these spiritual prodigies, you realize they come in with their own unique ministry for their time, but they're not limited to that. As spirit and as soul, personable, recognizable, palpable presence with whom you can interact interpersonally, Jesus still is. A friend of mine, Jewish from birth, became by his own admission a petty thief and criminal, later became very smitten with the Indian godman Mehar Baba, who passed on in 1969. That old idea, don't worry, be happy. Bobby McFerrin made a big song out of it about a dozen years ago. That was Mehar Baba's slogan. Do your best and don't worry, be happy, because all is God. One day he's sitting in his living room, this chap, St. Ken Cedar, and he'd never been to a Christian church, never really read the New Testament at all. Love Mehar Baba, he was Jewish by birth, and not very religious too. Suddenly Jesus is standing in his living room. And Ken, after a while, he was just feeling overwhelmed with love and bliss and kindness and healing energy. A lot of his own dark past being healed. And he says, he knew it was Jesus, and he said, I'm not a Christian. And Jesus said, neither am I. I mean, it's a joke, but it's a true story. Jesus continues to completely flood the heart, mind, soul of beings. It was me out in the backyard feeling he was atop the whole heavenly pantheon with a special ministry to turn people on who had grown up Catholic or Christian or maybe in another faith, but who might be open to a particular signature vibrational quality of his love.
So is that why the resurrection is so important?
Yeah, and then we got a big problem, because did the body literally resurrect, or did, as St. Paul put it and many other Christians, was it a spiritual resurrection?
Was there any other religious, in any other religious tradition, mm-hmm. did a religious leader of that kind die and rise?
Milarepa, 12th, 13th century Tibetan mystic, saint, yogi, poet, wonder worker. He resurrected himself temporarily for a few days, as I recall, so he could be alive and present for one of his dearest disciples who was coming from another part of Tibet and didn't reach in time. He was poisoned to death by a jealous monk, but he resurrected himself to give some final teachings to one of his closest disciples. That's one case I know of. He's like the patron saint of Tibet. I have a huge long thing about him on my website. If you go to that enlightened-spirituality.org website, and I have business cards over there. So, and of course, Alice put it at the end. Apparently she put that in there. And go mainly to the religion and spirituality section to learn about all the world religions and so many of the saints. This handout on Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, comes from that religion and spirituality section. If you're interested in this non-dual mystical spirituality, go to the non-dual spirituality section of the website. And if you're interested in all the social justice stuff and like the liberation theology formation and the official Catholic catechism statements about social justice and so forth, go to the engaged spirituality section. At every page on my website, at the upper left, are these little buttons with all these different sections and domains. What's that?
A couple things. Christianity, it seems to me, has a very shameful history. So many
All three of the Western monotheisms do, but especially Christianity, because they've got allied with secular power.
Right.
And Constantinople.
Did
Christian.
Not realize if Jesus, the sage prophet, did he not realize
what was going to happen in his name?
And if he did, why didn't he write anything?
He gave the Gospel of Thomas for us. So, those kind of teachings, and he gave us the Q text kind of saying. He spoke about love thy enemy and forgive your brother, not seven times, but 70 times seven. Everything about him was whole and wholesome and holy. It came out of someone who was healed by the divine. Nolan brings this out very well, I think, in one of the later chapters that. I don't want to stick too close to the text because you guys can read the text and see what he says for himself. I'm going to give you a lot more context and elaboration than that. But it's going to happen. How could the Buddha have foreseen, a Nichiren Shoshu movement in 13th century Japan where Nichiren is calling other Buddhists heretics, and as a fanatic, he starts trying to stamp out other forms of Buddhism? How could he be predicted the Japanese imperialist regime in the 20th century creating fascism and launching the Pacific Theater of World War II.
But the impact of Christianity on the world, and certainly the Western world, has been just so enormous.
Yeah, you know what? I'm a student of this history, and I see the massive amount of suffering, and overall I see more good than evil. I see billions of human beings with other lives uplifted and healed and transformed. And God's love them.
Christianity?
In Christianity. And I no longer practice as a Christian, I would say, in answer to that question. Like many of you, I felt just, the party line of Christianity by the time I was 18, a couple of years into these deep mystical experiences. I realized Christianity is suppressing the real essence of what Jesus was living, the spirituality himself was living and trying to communicate. So there are churches that have reclaimed the mystical legacy of Jesus and the open table fellowship and the justice, spirit of justice, that cynic temperament in the best sense of the word, the social prophet in the best sense of that word, and also now environmental prophets, But you have to look at the fact that more than any other religion, probably, Christianity has suppressed its own greatest mystics while they were actually alive, more than any tradition. What can one say about a tradition who takes all the, every time a really saintly, sagely person appears, male or female, of any kind of tremendous excellence, they get suppressed and branded a heretic or pressured in different ways? Pope John Paul II and others, when he made those denigrating statements about Buddhism as being a religion of indifference and so forth before his trip to Asia. I forget what year that was. I wrote a long missive and sent it out to the Vatican and Kung and Buddhists like Robert Thurman and others talking about, you know, the Buddhist model of a kind of trans-theism or supra-theism, because they're not atheists. But remember at the time, Pope John Paul II was lamenting how, you know, so many Christians had gone off to the East. You must know the Catholic Church, Ratzinger, you know, Pope Benedict, he was the right-hand man and the man for orthodoxy and orthopraxy, right belief and right practice. They put out an anathema that Christians should not practice yoga. Ludicrous. You know, it's more of this trying to suppress a real mystical spirituality. The church would be dead today were it not reclaiming its tradition of mysticism. The Dominicans, no one's a Dominican, have rehabilitated Meister Eckhart. Eckhart gets quoted about 30 times in this book. We're talking about the real Eckhart, not Ulrich Tolle, who called himself Eckhart Tolle, the modern writer. We're talking about Meister Eckhart 700 years ago. Christianity's greatest mistake. That's a huge thing on Eckhart and my website. And John of the Cross and St. Francis and others. But there's something amiss about a tradition that has gotten so orthodox, so orthodox, so institutionalized that it persecutes all its greatest mystics and then later celebrates them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I mean, John Paul II was a big fan of St. John of the Cross. But in his lifetime, we know what happened to St. John of the Cross. The unreformed Carmelites put him in a dungeon-like prison. He almost died. He had a lot of flack. And toward the end of his life, some of those factions ganged up against him and tried to banish him. Meister Eckhart was dragged before a Franciscan, a Dominican was dragged before a Franciscan board of inquisitors, basically, and told he was a heretic. He lived long enough to write a beautiful defense. It's one of the great documents in Christianity. St. Teresa of Avila, the co-founder of the Reformed Carmelites with John of the Cross, had a huge amount of flack. Much of her work was, there was an attempt to suppress it, stop it, nip it in the bud. This woman's levitating, you know, her fellow sisters are seeing that. She was just so completely holy that a huge faction of the church thought she was with the devil. So, there's problems with institutionalism, and yet, look at, say, Thomas Merton and a Dorothy Day and the civil rights movement in the South in the 60s, starting in the 50s, who are not for the institutional power of the churches. You know, the message would not have gotten out. Civil rights movement, LBJ never would have signed into legislation the Civil Rights Act were it not for the network of Catholic churches, evangelical churches, you know, Anglican Protestant churches. So we have to take the good with the bad. I see it all as a divine comedy. Periods, moments, terrible instances of horrendous tragedy and trauma from what Stalin did in Russia and Hitler did with 6 million Jews.
Do you think that could be any connection between what she's talking about and in the with the uprising of, I don't want to bring it up, but it kind of seems like it goes there with the patriarchal, you know, from the Greek in the Greek tradition,
yeah.
And, you know, which has started in the Greek tradition,
yeah.
And then building up so that it's more appointed, more logical, more linear type thing.
Yeah, the institutionalization of sacramental power has been fought by scholars.
Whereas in the traditions in the East, or like in Hindu tradition, there is still much more of a feminine god,
very much
feminine
so,
type, and you know, and even bisexual, if you will, in all mm-hmm. statues, mm-hmm. you know, where the god can have breasts. And a penis, or
like the Shiva, Shakti, androgynous form,
exactly.
Right side of the body
is
masculine, left side
is
feminine.
And Kali Ma. So could that be part of what she's talking about, where it seems like the Christian tradition is brutal?
Excessively patriarchalized?
Yeah. And where
along happens. With the Jewish tradition and the Muslim tradition.
Exactly.
I see that with all three monotheisms.
The same contrary of the building is at the same time period. And so that this is more of a larger, much larger cosmic type.
Yeah.
Building and, you know.
I agree. I also see patriarchalism is tied in very much, not just with the economics of it and the clanship model of it, but it's very much, psychologically speaking, the authoritarian personality temperament. This is what needs to be rooted out in all the faiths. You know, there's a patriarchalist authoritarianism creeping into Hinduism in the 20th and now 21st century with the Hindutva and the RSS and the BJP party. These guys tend to be very patriarchal in many respects. And they're like Hindu fascists, just like we have these Islamo fascists and Christian fascists and ultra-Orthodox right-wing Haredi and Jewish fascists, which they're depriving, you know, modern Orthodox, let alone conservative or Reform Jews from being considered Jews, allowing the Palestinians to have a second state, their own state in the Palestinian area. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question about the, your. I have two little tidbits of information that I think are intriguing.
Yeah.
In zoology, particularly that branch specializes in wild animals in captivity. There have been recorded many examples of female mammals becoming pregnant and giving birth who have been isolated.
Intriguing.
And it's, there have been so many examples that they actually have a name for it, which is genosynthesis.
And I was not aware of that. That's an interesting bit of information.
The most recent, so in a way you could say it's
It could be a natural.
In this case, an example, the most recent one could be called an immaculate birth of an orca baby whale. In the Miami the Miami Aquarium last year,
I got that seriously.
It was the mother had been in isolation because of the killer aspect that they can get into for something like 9 or 10 years, way past any kind of gestation you were aware of. And so that was made the headlines.
Yeah. You know, much of today we've been talking on a more didactic level and instructional and more about facts and values and history and so forth. What's really important is realizing this divine being beyond being, this transpersonal reality in which all of us persons flourish. As you said, the beautiful new version of the prayer, glory be to the one in whom we live, move, and have our being. If I could just leave you with something, what Jesus is really living, his own spirituality, this intimacy with Abba, the personal Father who's also transpersonal or superpersonal. And as long as you take yourself as a person, God is only too happy to appear as a person for you, the loving Father or the Divine Mother. Brother David Steinlerosa, with whom I sat for about 2 weeks up at New Kamalgalig, invited me to come in and help him. He's trying to get a book going, and he knew he could dialogue with me and stimulate his thinking. So he invited me up there. It's a very lovely retreat for me and time with Brother David Steinlerosa, this great Catholic monk and author. Brother David would often say, if you listen to Jesus in the parables and instruction, the way he's presenting God, like in the prodigal son story, is often more like a good Jewish mother than just a father. Not that fathers can be extremely warm, loving, unconditionally loving and forgiving, but he says so often, you know, it's a very maternal image of God. We know that ancient names like El Shaddai, the Hebrew word, usually translated as God the mountainous one, like a mountain, also apparently means, it's a feminine emblem, it can mean the breast, like the nourishing suckle of the breast. So, as long as we take ourselves to be persons, and no one is communicating a lot in the book, Abba, the focus of Jesus is spirituality, the inspiration for his spirituality. Intimate, loving, unconditionally loving Father. you can include the mother part there quite clearly, David Steinberg. But beyond the sense of being merely a person, a body, mind, and soul, a person who wants to love more and feel the love and be a servant of that love, active in some kind of ministry, guided and inspired by God, what really will open us up and empower all of our personal ministry and personal development and working through psychological issues and so forth will be when we really open up the transpersonal depths. God prior to and beyond the merely personal. And I encourage you to read especially the passages in the Gospel of Thomas. And the handout that Ali is so kind. I don't know where you get the resources. You copy so many things and told these students.
In my garage.
Oh, great. Thank you for that. And this is at your website. If you want to send it on to a friend, you don't have to laboriously Xerox it. You can send them the link at the website. And also, we have a Tuesday night gathering every Tuesday, and we go very deeply into just a pure, open, mystical, transpersonal, but including the personal, but especially transpersonal, kind of spiritual inquiry process based on the great mystical wisdom of Jesus, the great Jewish and Sufi Muslim mystics, and especially the Eastern mystics as well. So anyone's invited to that. Just email me if you're inspired, and I'll get you the directions. It means on a property up in the San Roque Hills where we have my mom, and the whole Eastern big office room we turned into a huge kind of meditative, contemplative space. And we meet there every Tuesday night when I'm in town from 7 to 9. It's free. We don't charge money for spirituality. That's a random one. Okay, I think I've overrun the time, and I didn't get nearly to enough questions, but you're also welcome to come to these Shock Center classes. And again, we meet at room 29 at the Shock Center down there at West Padre, just below Cottage Hospital. Today we're going to, in our Healing Our World class, be focusing on globalization. We'll watch this hour-long conversation with John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman about the underbelly of how globalization works. So, more of your social justice, passion inspiring. Yeah. Next week, I think we'll do Dorothy Day. I'll show you some old interviews with Bill Moyer from like 35 years ago.
Okay. I just want to extend a big thank you to Timothy. Just listening to him talk about getting depressed or wanting to hyperventilate, I understand what Kahard means by complexity, consciousness. I mean, and I hope we never take for granted or reduce to too simple a formula our understanding of the sacred or the divine. You're just a wealth of information, and I do. It almost makes me want to think how to... Where's the thread that pulls it all together? And what came to me was the message I've told you all I've been getting for months now, just, you know, shut up. Shut up and sit in that silent presence, and the thread that pulls it all together sinks deep. But thank you for helping us not to take for granted something so high and wide and deep as what you are presenting to us. So thank you very much.